So in this time when we just started offering the precious blood last Sunday, as we'll continue to do, we're reminding people of some practical things of receiving communion. So I wrote a whole paper on the historical development of the practice of distributing communion in the hand. And it's 15 pages long, so I won't go through that here. But I'll gladly email it to you if you email me requesting it. What I will say is this. Pope Paul VI vigorously opposed the development of the practice, but felt powerless to stop it. There are a lot of reasons used to justify the introduction and expansion of communion in the hand in various parts of the world, which he specifically rejected in Memoriale Domini, the relevant motu proprio on the issue to this day. So why does the Church prefer communion on the tongue? First and foremost, there's the practical reason that we believe every particle of a sacred host contains the fullness of Jesus' body, blood, soul, and divinity. There is much less risk of particles being dropped or lost when you receive communion on the tongue. Secondly, there is a greater reverence when you receive communion, better symbol of receiving communion rather than taking communion. That you are fed, you don't feed yourself. We are fed by Christ. He feeds our soul. We do not sustain our own spiritual life. We are children before God, our Father. Okay, so that is theologically why there's a preference for communion on the tongue. And practically, we also have the communion rail at this church. And while this was a relatively later development, only becoming universal around 1600, the kneeling posture is also a demonstration of reverence before the presence of Jesus in the Eucharist. For myself as a minister, it is also easier to distribute communion when someone is kneeling, that they don't move around as much, generally. That being said, if you can't kneel physically because you have bad knees or for whatever reason, Jesus doesn't make unreasonable demands of us. And so don't worry about it. The standing position was the position to receive communion for several centuries before 1600. If you do receive on the hand, one hand on top of the other, not both hands out like this. And please consume the host in front of the minister. That there have been times when I've said to myself, well, I don't think this is the kind of person who's stealing a host, but I can't really tell because they're consuming it five steps down the aisle with their back to me, and I can't see if there's anything in their hand or not. And we do know that that is a reality. If you're receiving on the tongue, open your mouth, don't look down. And I know not all priests will say this, but if you can't open your mouth and stick out your tongue at the same time, I would much rather have you have your mouth open with your tongue inside than you stick your tongue out with your mouth closed at me. And you don't need your tongue touching your chin either, because then I'm worried about Jesus sliding off. So just some practical things here. But with the precious blood, please use both hands to hold the chalice. So if you don't have both hands available because you're holding a child or using a cane or you have a broken arm or whatever the case may be, then please just receive Jesus in the host. That the precious blood is a fuller symbol of the gift of Christ, but you receive just as much Jesus, body, blood, soul, and divinity in the host. So all of this should be centered around Jesus' great desire to receive us and for us to receive him in the Eucharist. That the Eucharist is the greatest gift that he gave us. God himself could not come up with a better gift to give us. And so while he does not demand what we cannot pay, he has paid for this gift in his blood. We could never respond with sufficient reverence to such a noble gift. And so any show of reverence that we can make to this sacrament, we should gladly give in thanksgiving for such a gift. Second homily, you may have noticed, as we've been reading Luke's gospel this year, that Luke has a particular emphasis on the poor. That the rich man in today's gospel ended up in purgatory a place of true suffering, because he did not see the poor man at his doorstep. So I had someone ask me recently, essentially, who is my neighbor? Or how am I supposed to serve the poor? And this is a question that I don't think I can really answer for each of you from the pulpit. But who is the poor man at our doorstep? For most of us, I think there is someone in our life whom we do not see. It may be someone whom we refuse to see. That difficult family member suffering from addiction, mental illness, chronic physical illness, just plain bad decisions, imprisonment, whatever the case may be. And it may be necessary to put severe limits on some people's access to our time, our money, or our children. But to cut a family member off completely, especially to cut them out of our prayer and the charity of our heart, is unacceptable. So there's those individually that perhaps we overlook or don't see. And then there's those who, as a society, the society does not see. As a church, I think we do a pretty good job of caring for those that society overlooks. But individually, I'm a believer that each person has a particular charism, a particular group of people that they're called to serve. And so, obviously, the first duty is to your family, to those within your household, not just at your doorstep. But once your duties to your family are met, then who else is God drawing you to serve? Maybe it's the poor through St. Vincent de Paul. That maybe it's the homeless, perhaps the unborn with our Arise ministry and crisis pregnancy centers. Perhaps it's vulnerable children, someone who shares a particular life experience with yourself of a time of darkness you got through that you want to help others through. Maybe mental illness or disability, the elderly living alone. The list goes on. There's one particular group, though, that I would like to comment on that our society disregards, that I've seen even among Catholics that concerns me. So Amos, in our first reading, prophesies against the people of the cities of Judah and Israel who are living comfortably on their ivory beds and their couches and their banquets while their rural brothers and sisters are being destroyed by their enemies and taken into exile. They say, essentially, not my tribe, not my problem, or not my town, not my problem. But many people in our society, and again, even some Catholics, have jumped on this bandwagon of deport all illegal immigrants. And our bishops have spoken very clearly about this in the United States. St. John Paul II, in his letter to the Church in America, Ecclesia in America, noted the rich Catholic culture that many of these immigrants bring with them, which, by the way, historically was one more reason used why they should not come here to corrupt our precious Protestant nation. And John Paul II, I'll quote him, that the Church in America must be a vigilant advocate, defending against any unjust restriction the natural right of individual persons to move freely within their own nation and from one nation to another. Attention must be called to the rights of migrants and their families and to respect for their human dignity, even in cases of non-legal immigration, end quote. So our church's magisterium, again, our bishops in our country and the Vatican have always consistently recognized the right of nations to defend their borders as well. So I would applaud, as would our church, the dramatic reduction of human trafficking and drug trafficking at our southern border this year. But there's still the question of what to do with people who are here who are not criminals, people who have built lives here, who work real jobs, many of them married to American citizens, and they're being deported. I know of a couple individuals who left because they want to do the right thing, but they are looking at the prospect of years of being separated from their families, over a year already, in fact. The fact of the matter is that for many years, we made it very easy to enter this country illegally and very difficult to do so legally. We were complicit in allowing the cartels to control large parts of the border, which was not good for anyone involved, least of all those here for honest, trying to come here for honest reasons. And there are immigrants who recognize that yes, I made a mistake, I should have gone through the process. I would like to correct that, but again, it's impossible for them to do that within our own country. They have to leave and then apply for legal entry, which at this point in time takes years again. So our Kansas bishops released a letter on the topic 1 month ago that's a single page long, so I encourage you to read that. But I will quote them here. Amid political division and fear, we remind our communities that at the center of every immigration debate are real people. Families in our pews, children in our schools, workers in our neighborhoods, and volunteers in our parishes. So this is not to say that of those long list of groups that I listed, this is one you're called to serve directly, but our church will. And whoever you're called to serve, we're called to ask God, who is the poor at our doorstep? And perhaps you serve already through volunteering or through your job. Perhaps you need to pray about who you might be called to serve. But all of us are called to see in the poor and the vulnerable of society the face of Christ, to see them with God the Father's eyes, to not allow their voices to be dismissed. So let us pray that as we receive Christ and we become more worthy of the name of Christian, that others may see him through us.